Morning.
Morning.
So we're going to be doing something a little different this morning, obviously. We're going to be working through Paul's voyage to Rome, and I thought it useful to be able to see a little bit of that. So I have a little bit of a presentation on that this morning. Hopefully everybody else can see. Okey dokey. Well, first what we're going to do is let's go ahead and turn over to Acts chapter 27. We've been working through an examination of the life of Paul, and we've been covered pretty much everything up until this point with quite a bit of detail. What we're going to be looking at today is basically just gives you an idea of the distance that he traveled and some of the places that he would have stopped along the way. And it's, again, you know, I don't know the last time that you've sailed in Montana, but I know they sail all the time in North Dakota, right? But that's on, you know, land yachts. But it's hard to really imagine, I think, for us, unless you've been on the sea. I don't really want to ever be on the sea, but unless you've been on the sea, it's really kind of hard to imagine. So I wanted to give you a little bit more of a visual. But before we get into that, just for today, let's go ahead and start. We're actually going to read pretty much most of the chapter of 27, just for the perspective that you'll get of the overall voyage. And then we're going to come back and look at some of the places. And we're actually going to start in Jerusalem with where Paul went, of course, from Jerusalem to Caesarea, where he spent a couple years. But let's go ahead and start here in Acts 27, verse 1. And like I said, we'll just read the whole chapter. All right. So when it was decided that we would sail for Italy, they proceeded to deliver Paul and some other prisoners to a centurion of the Augustan cohort named Julius. And embarking in an Adramidian ship, which was about to sail to the regions along the coast of Asia, we put out to sea accompanied by Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica. The next day we put in at Sidon, and Julius treated Paul with consideration and allowed him to go to his friends and receive care. From there we put out to sea and sailed under the shelter of Cyprus because the winds were contrary. When we had sailed through the sea along the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy, and he put us aboard it. When we had sailed slowly for a good many days and with difficulty had arrived off Cnidus, since the wind did not permit us to go farther, we sailed under the shelter of Crete off Salmone, and with difficulty sailing past it, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. When considerable time had passed and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them and said to them, "Men, I perceive that the voyage will certainly be with damage and great loss, not only of the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives." But the centurion was persuaded by the pilot and the captain of the ship, but the centurion was more persuaded by the pilot of the captain, pilot and the captain of the ship than by what was being said by Paul, because the harbor was not suitable for wintering. The majority reached the decision to put out to sea from there if somehow they could reach Phoenix, a harbor of Crete, facing southwest and northwest, and spend the winter there. When a moderate south wind came up, supposing that they had attained their purpose, they weighed anchor and began sailing along Crete close inshore. But before very long, there rushed down from the land a violent wind called a euroquilo. And when the ship was caught in it and could not face the wind, we gave way to it and let ourselves be driven along. Running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. After they had hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Citrus, they let down the sea anchor, and in this way let themselves be driven along. The next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo, and on the third day they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. When they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. Yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, and for there will be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of God, to whom I belong and whom I serve, stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar, and behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island.' But when the 14th night came, as we were being driven about in the Adriatic Sea, about midnight, the sailors began to surmise that they were approaching some land. They took soundings and found it to be 20 fathoms. And a little farther on, they took another sounding and found it to be 15 fathoms. Fearing that we might run aground somewhere on the rocks, they cast four anchors from the stern and wished for daybreak. But as the sailors were trying to escape from the ship and had let down the ship's boat into the sea on the pretense of intending to lay out anchors from the bow, Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, 'Unless these men remain in the ship, you yourselves cannot be saved.' Then the soldiers cut away the ropes of the ship's boat and let it fall away. Until the day was about to dawn, Paul was encouraging them all to take some food, saying, 'Today is the 14th day that you have been constantly watching and going without eating, having taken nothing. Therefore, I encourage you to take some food, for this is for your preservation, for not a hair from the head of any of you will perish.' Having said this, he took bread and gave thanks to God in the presence of all, and he broke it and began to eat. All of them were encouraged, and they themselves took food. All of us in the ship were 276 persons. When they had eaten enough, they began to lighten the ship by throwing out the wheat into the sea. When day came, they could not recognize the land, but they did observe a bay with a beach, and they resolved to drive the ship onto it if they could. And casting off the anchors, they left them in the sea, while at the same time they were loosening the ropes of the rudders and hoisting the foresail to the wind. They were heading for the beach. But striking a reef where two seas met, they ran the vessel aground, and the prow stuck fast and remained immovable. But the stern began to be broken up by the force of the waves. The soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners so that none of them would swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard at first and get to land, and the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And so it happened that they all were brought safely to land." There's a lot of stuff that's happening here. There's a lot of detail here that we're going to get into a little bit of it. Some of it is, I don't think, adds a lot of extra value to talk too much about some of the cities they pass and whatnot. But here's kind of the basic point. Paul had eventually gotten the opportunity to start heading to Rome. This is something that he'd want to do for a long time. We've talked about this throughout the book of Acts. It's mentioned several times in the book of Acts, as well as in, obviously, the book of Romans, chapter 1 and chapter 15. And, of course, the Lord had revealed in a vision to him that he was going to go to Rome, that he was going to speak before Caesar. Now, Paul, as we know, he's not going as a tourist. He's going as a prisoner. Of course, we know that he was arrested in Jerusalem a couple years earlier from this, from Acts chapter 21. He defended himself in various trials in Jerusalem and in Caesarea. Anybody remember how many times he was on trial between Jerusalem and Caesarea? It was a good fistful. So there was five of them. So five different trials, essentially. The first time before the mob in Jerusalem. The second before the Sanhedrin Council in Jerusalem. And then, of course, before FFA, Felix, Festus, and Agrippa. Okay, the reason he was going to Rome, besides of the things we talked about with God saying, "You're going to go," but why was he going to Rome specifically? Anybody remember? He appealed to Caesar. Felix, Festus, and Agrippa, none of them found anything wrong with him and nothing worthy of death. And as chapter 26 finishes out, basically, if he hadn't appealed to Caesar, he would have been set free. However, and you kind of think about it, I don't know how free he would have been because the Jews were still seeking to kill him. So he took the opportunity to appeal to Caesar and rescued himself from the hands of the Jews. If you go back to Acts chapter 26, I find this interesting. Acts chapter 26, when Paul is giving his defense before Agrippa, he actually makes a very specific statement about this. Let's start in verse 16. This is, of course, the Lord speaking to him. He says, "But get up and stand on your feet, for this purpose I have appeared to you, to appoint you a minister and a witness, not only to the things which you have seen, but also to the things which I will appear to you, rescuing you from the Jewish people and from the Gentiles to whom I am sending you." So the Lord told him, way back on the road to Damascus, that he was going to rescue him from the Jews. Find it interesting that he used the Romans to do that. But at any rate, Paul is on the way, and of course the voyage would not be without trials of its own. Traveling by sea was extremely hazardous in those days. Paul had certainly already experienced some of the perils of the sea by this time. If we go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 11, you'll notice that Paul, before these events, writes of the shipwrecks that he had encountered. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, let's just start verse 25. He says, "Three times I was beaten with rods, once I was stoned, three times I was shipwrecked, a night and a day I have spent in the deep. I have been on frequent journeys and dangers from rivers, dangers from robbers, dangers from my countrymen, dangers from the Gentiles, dangers in the city, dangers in the wilderness, dangers on the sea, dangers among false brethren." So we often, and I know that this is the way my mind works, so yours probably works somewhat the same, is that when you read this in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, you think he's referencing what's happened in Acts chapter 27. But he'd already written these before these events had occurred. So a lot of the things that Paul had already undergone, specifically the three shipwrecks, they're not recorded any other place in the New Testament. It's the only place that they're mentioned. So this one in Acts chapter 27 is technically his fourth that we know of. Okay? So Paul had certainly already encountered some of that, and he understood what the trip was, the difficulties of the trip. So the first leg of the trip was from Caesarea to Myra. Couple of things first. Let's go back to Acts chapter 27, verse 1. See a couple of things here. Paul was placed in the care of Julius, who was a Roman centurion. He was of the Augustus Regiment. It's a division that consists of approximately 400 to 600 men, perhaps named in honor of the Roman Emperor Augustus. This was kind of a special regiment. It wasn't the everyday, "Hi, I'm a Roman soldier, part of whatever regiment." The Augustus Regiment had specific and special duties in regards to the emperor. So he was also sent along with some of the other prisoners. Now, as we see, and especially as we get into the events that will happen in Malta and with the rest of the shipwreck, Paul takes every opportunity to preach the gospel. He's not in it for himself. And these prisoners will come in to play a little bit later. But Paul was also joined by two friends. Anybody name one of them? Luke, yeah, Luke's one of them. How do we know Luke's there? Right, he writes Acts, but there were other times when Luke wasn't there and he still wrote about it. How do we know Luke was there? Thank you. Pronouns are important. Verse 1, when it was decided that we would sail for Italy. So at this point, Luke joins Paul along with Aristarchus from Macedonia. Anybody remember anything about Aristarchus? He's mentioned a couple of times. Let's go back to Acts chapter 19. I appreciate how Luke was careful to record things like this, and Aristarchus joining Paul, he almost gets a sideline mention. You know, Aristarchus was there too. But I want this to serve as a bit of a lesson, but I'll come back to that. So Acts chapter 19, Verse 28, this is, of course, back when Paul is in Ephesus and things had started to go a little awry. Verse 28, when they heard this and were filled with rage, they began crying out, saying, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." The city was filled, filled with the confusion, and they rushed with one accord into the theater, dragging along Gaius and Aristarchus, Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia. So Aristarchus had already faced the mob in Ephesus, had traveled with Paul from Macedonia, so was very well known to the crew here. And of course, he later returned to Asia with Paul, Acts chapter 20, verse 4. And he, this is Paul, was accompanied by Sopater of Berea, the son of Pyrrhus, and by Aristarchus and Secundus of the Thessalonians, and Gaius and Derbe and Timothy and Tychicus and Trophimus of Asia. So Aristarchus had been accompanying Paul for quite a while. And then later on, Paul describes him in a very specific way. Anybody remember what that was? Colossians chapter 4. Verse 10, this is, of course, Paul writing the church in Colossae, and he says, "Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greetings." And he goes on and talks about some other folks. So he was referred to as a fellow prisoner. And if we go over to Philemon, obviously, chapter 1. So this letter, of course, written to Philemon regarding his slave, Onesimus, he writes in verse 24, well, let's do 23 as he's closing this out. He says, "Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, greets you, as do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, Luke, my fellow workers." So Aristarchus is mentioned here a couple of times, and he's one of those guys who had been real consistent in traveling with Paul. So a couple of things that might spring to mind here regarding Aristarchus is that he had left from Macedonia following Paul and went to Jerusalem, where Paul, after about a week, was captured by the Jews and then spent 2 years in Caesarea. Where is Aristarchus at this time? Any ideas? Yeah. Probably in Jerusalem and Caesarea. Why not? He had traveled this far with Paul, and it wasn't like he could just jump on a plane and be back in a couple of days. It would have taken a long time and a fairly large expense to get back to Macedonia. So Paul, it's probable to assume that Paul had Aristarchus as a companion while Aristarchus stayed in Palestine, and he probably made himself useful to the church. He probably didn't just hang out and, "Oh, woe is me, why did I come this far? Poor Paul, he's in prison, and those Jews, they're so mean to him." I'm sure Aristarchus made himself useful. He took the opportunity while he was in Jerusalem, I'm sure, to encourage the church. And then when Paul was transferred to Caesarea, he probably went up and hung out with who in Caesarea? Remember who else is in Caesarea about this time? I mentioned his name a few times. He is an evangelist. Go ahead. Philip. Philip the Evangelist and the congregation that he had started. So Aristarchus probably spent some time there as well. Now, this is conjecture, but it makes sense. Okay? So, back to Acts chapter 27. Verse 2, it mentions there that they were placed on an Adramidian ship. Not a lot we want to talk about there, other than it was a maritime town of Mysia in Asia Minor. It was located between Troas and Pergamos. That's where the Adramidian ship had come from. And then they began traveling along the coast of Phoenicia. So let's going to try to do this on a very small platform here. But I'm going to bring up that map for you. All righty. Is that blurry? No? just my bifocals. Not that I need them. They were just fashionable at the time. So, just want to start here. This is obviously Jerusalem. It's funny when you start, well, if you want to find, I don't know if anybody knows what a Google Earth overlay is. They're basically like a 3D rendering of buildings and whatnot. You can find all sorts of stuff for the Dome of the Rock. Try to find one for the Herod's Temple. I couldn't find it. So, at any rate, just give you a little bit of an idea here. So this is where the temple was. Obviously, there's a Muslim temple there now. But one of the things I find interesting, this is the Mount of Olives. So Paul would have spent some time, certainly in the temple grounds, being harassed by the Jews. From there, he went over, if you remember, he had traveled from the city of Jerusalem. And then along the way, he made a short stop in Antipatris, and there's actually a national park there now, which I find rather interesting. Not a lot left of the original city or settlement, at least not in its obviously original state. One of the things you'll notice is that if you were to take a map of the ancient Roman roads and overlay the current interstate or highway system, guess what? They followed the Roman roads. They were that well built, and they made that much sense. So while you'll see some of these major highways, that's essentially where the Roman roads were. Okay, they may not be exactly there, but they followed essentially the same path. So from Antipatris, they moved up to Caesarea. And then in Caesarea, Paul spent about 2 years in Herod's Praetorium. So the Herod's Praetorium, the remains are actually pretty much under almost a constant state of renewal, if you will. They're always finding new evidence to support the fact that this is Herod's Praetorium, but other archaeological finds continue to drive interest in the area. If you remember, let me stop this. If you remember, when we were talking about this initially, I'm going to drop him right about there. We looked at we mentioned where Paul would have been staying in the area. And so you can kind of see from this aerial photo, this is the original Herod's Praetorium. This is the main portion of the palace. Now, of course, you think about the palace at that time, it would have looked a whole lot different. There would have been columns and a lot of beauty to it. They had this, you know, pool that they built out in the ocean, and, you know, fresh water could come in, and It was pretty magnificent in its day. Paul would have been housed somewhere in this back portion, the front portion being the living quarters for the governor and his protection and guards. And if you remember, I had mentioned that while Paul was in prison for 2 years in the Praetorium, he probably would have heard the games going on outside. This is the Hippodrome right here. So all of this is seating that goes along the edge. And they would have had things like chariot races going on. Now, I doubt that they would have given the prisoners much of an option to, you know, look out the window and have a front row seat. There probably weren't many windows that faced that direction, but Paul would have heard the noise for 2 years. But not being able to partake if he wished to do so. There's the primary theater here. And it's funny, from this aerial picture, they were having a concert there. They still use it as a concert venue. You know, it's amazing to think, because, you know, I think about the oldest things in Montana are about 150 years old. You know, this is old, 2,000 years old, and they still use it. We can't even build a road that lasts a winter. But at any rate, this is where Paul would have spent about 2 years, where he would have been able to speak to Festus and Felix, Festus and Agrippa. From here, as they are set to leave, wait for the screen to flip back around here. You can see this first line here is where they leave from Caesarea, and then they're going to make the trip up to Sidon. So, at Sidon, Paul's able to stop, and despite the fact that he is being escorted by the Roman Empire to go speak to Caesar, to plead his case before Caesar, as it says there in verse 3, Paul is allowed to visit some friends and to receive care. So this particular section of the trip would not have taken too long, and as they were, oops, I can't do it on that piece of paper. As they were traveling along that route along the shore, it would not have taken that long. So from there, they leave from Sidon, and they go all the way over to Myra. Now, I put in a couple of stops here, a couple of points, because there's a couple of things that I wanted to chat about real quickly. As they were leaving from Sidon, and then they were going around Cyprus, they eventually wanted to end up at the city of Myra, which is over here. If you're wondering what the words in parentheses are, those are the current names of the cities. It's not like you can just look up Myra and find it on a map. It takes a ridiculous amount of time to figure those out. But during this particular time of the year, and really time in history, for the most part, seafaring was still done along the shore. It was because it was very difficult and challenging, especially this time of year. Now, we touched on it or we read it, but do you remember approximately what time of year this was? What was the event that Paul had mentioned or Luke had mentioned had already happened? What's that? The feast, which would have been in what time of the year? Yeah, would have been in the fall. Now, traveling across the Mediterranean Sea here in the fall would have been dangerous. Anywhere after November would have been suicide. A lot of it is because of the way that the winds blow. In this particular case, they decided to go along the shore. Now, in say the spring and summer, some ships would go right directly from Sidon over to Myra, but certainly not in this case. Mike, did you have a comment? So in this particular case, they decided because of the time of year and because it would have been difficult, because they didn't have powered boats. I mean, they had some of the ships had oars, but it would have taken a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous crew to row across the Mediterranean Sea. So instead what they do is they sail under Cyprus. Basically what that means is that they sailed along the eastern edge of Cyprus in this area because of the winds that would have been coming down from the north and the east. Okay? So if the winds are blowing to the northeast, which direction is the ship going to want to go? It's going to want to go the other direction, right? Northwest to southeast. So the winds are blowing out of the northwest, and the ship would have been tried to be blown into the southeast. So, of course, this explains why they went along the edge of the shore there. From Sidon, they sail under Cyprus. If you remember, Paul had spent some time in Cyprus. First missionary journey, right? It's one of the first stops he had made as he left the mainland. Then they continued off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia. There's Antioch, obviously, where the church was first called Christians. Tarsus, where Paul was born, so it was an area that he was pretty familiar with. I did put a couple of stops at what were primary harbors at the time. While it doesn't mention specifically that he stopped in the harbors, this is a fairly decent trip. This would have taken 10 to 15 days. And it was very common that they would have to stop and get supplies. So most likely, just based upon historical evidence, they would have made a couple of stops in here before continuing on over to Myra. Now, by this time, Myra was a very important city, especially in terms of navigation. Very wealthy city. And it's funny when you pretty much any time you look at a Roman city at this time, one of the things they say is that they were wealthy and full of debauchery. So, yeah, pretty much like every other Roman city at the time. So they do eventually make their way over to the city of Myra. There's Antioch. You know, it's pretty interesting. If you look, you can still find a lot of the old ruins from this particular time frame in Antioch. Tarsus still exists as the same city today. Again, to me, that's mind-boggling. A lot of these city names have changed, but not all of them. They do eventually make their way over to Myra. I mentioned Perga here because it was one of the cities in Pamphylia that Paul had spent some time, one of the areas where they had landed. And if you remember, there was a pretty important event that had occurred in Perga of Pamphylia. Anybody remember that? Let's go over to Acts chapter 13. Verse 13, now Paul and his companions put out to sea from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia, but John left them and returned to Jerusalem. So this is the city where John bailed on the first missionary journey and decided that it wasn't for him, at least not for the time being. Let's go over to chapter 14 as well. Just speaking in reference to Pamphylia in general and Perga, verse 24, they passed through Pisidia and came into Pamphylia. When they had spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. So definitely had spent some time in the city of Perga. Just kind of gives you again an idea of where Paul was during some of his other missionary journeys. All right. So they do eventually land in the city, or arrive, I should say, in the city of Myra. It's a part of Lycia, just obviously to the west of Pamphylia there. And at Myra, they book a passage on an Alexandrian ship sailing to Italy. So one of the things that this helps you to understand is that the Romans didn't necessarily have dedicated ships going back and forth, you know, as part of their regular trips back and forth to Rome. The Roman centurion had to stop and had to find a ship that was going over to Italy. Now, what does he mean by Alexandrian? Where was the ship out of? Alexandria. Which is? Anybody have an idea? Egypt. Okay, so he would have found a slightly different, slightly differently configured ship if it was from Alexandria. Which again, I appreciate Luke's specificity in this stuff. Gives you a better idea. I'm not going to get into the details of the differences in the ships. It's really not all that important. I just found it interesting that Luke continues to mention these little details that help us to understand that he wasn't just spinning a yarn. All right, so they booked this ship, and it's sailing to Italy. Now, this first leg of the trip really seemed to have been pretty pleasant. Not a lot of issues, you know, faced a little bit of a wind outside of Cyprus. Not a big deal, but as you know, and as we read, going forward, really, this particular portion of the trip was pretty easy compared to anything that they're going to experience in the next leg of the voyage. So they go from this town of Myra into Malta. I'll zoom out here just a sec. You can kind of see. So their point, or they go from Myra and they want to get, and they end up all the way over here. This is my description of, you know, letting them be cast about by the sea. And they end up all the way over here, keep going, in Malta. So this is a fairly long distance that, of course, it doesn't happen all at once. But they leave from Myra, and then from there, they end up basically taking a bit of a slow boat, if you will. But at any rate, they make it over to the city of Cnidus. They arrive with difficulty off the coast. It's obviously in Asia Minor. Little bit of cool perspective here as well. If I can find my mouse. So one of the things you'll notice about this area is that a lot of them don't have long sloping beaches. They generally have very narrow beaches with very steep terrain up to the cities themselves. So what we'll see here when we get to this next one, when you think of say, a couple of the other places they stop, like Lycia or Fair Havens, Phoenix, you think that these are large, well-developed cities. At the time, they weren't, and they're still not. So, at any rate, they arrive with some difficulty there in Nidus, and then they get to what is called Fair Haven. Let's let that flip back around here. So, there's that Salmone, by the way. That's that promontory point that's mentioned that they sail under it. This is one of those kind of things that for sailors, it makes a big difference. You know where you are. It's a very visible landmark. Okay, and then they eventually sail around here. And they end up in Fair Havens, the little town of Lycia. Not very big. Okay? And again, you look at the coastline, it's pretty steep. Little beach there, but that's the city of Lycia. And if you go over to Fair Haven, it's not much bigger. So it's not like these were places that they could stay. Because as you read on, you'll recognize that they decided that they couldn't stay there. And they needed to leave. Well, there's nothing there. I think Lycia, or no, this particular town, at least from what the census data was from 2020, there are a whopping 21 people that lived in this town. And probably not all that different than it was when Paul was there. Okay? And by the way, there's a shipwreck right there. I think that's kind of interesting. You can go look at it. It's pretty cool. So, obviously, not exactly a great place for them to stay. So, Acts chapter 27, verse 9. Let's read that real quickly. So, Acts chapter 27. Actually, let's go back just a verse here. Verse 8, and with difficulty sailing past it, this is Salmone, we came to a place called Fair Havens, near which was the city of Lycia. When considerable time had passed, and the voyage was now dangerous, since even the fast was already over, Paul began to admonish them. So they spent quite a bit of time in this area, and because of their delay, it was getting later and later and later in the year. And remember, as I mentioned, trying this trip in November, which it was getting close to, was pretty much near suicide. It was not going to be an easy trip. But the Day of Atonement, or the fast, was already over. This, of course, would have been around September, October time. As we know, Paul's like, this isn't good. They ignore his advice. And Paul, of course, from verses 9 through 12 there, he perceives, and I'm sure it was an angel from God and, you know, all the Jesus beams telling him, this isn't a good idea, you're all going to die. No, he didn't have a vision. He just perceived, probably from his experience in three previous shipwrecks, that this wasn't going to go so well. He perceived that the voyage would end in disaster, with loss of cargo and ship, and with loss of their lives. And of course, the centurion, he is persuaded otherwise by the helmsman and the owner of the ship. And because this harbor at Fair Havens wasn't suitable for winter, the majority prevailed. mob rule is a wonderful thing. And they decided to try for Phoenix. Now, let's go to this next one here. So, Phoenix is right here. So where they're trying to get, if you remember, it had a very particular and very peculiar description of Phoenix. Anybody remember what that was? Phoenix had a harbor that faced both southwest and northwest. So if you zoom in here, there's the harbor on both sides. So they were going to try to get here. And look at all those people. Wow. Huge city. And they were going to try to harbor here. You can see, again, not a lot of beach. really sharp sides, steep cliffs, not a really very well, it doesn't produce a lot of agricultural benefits, okay? But this is where they were going to try to stop. Now, of course, they didn't make it. That'll make you dizzy. And instead of actually making it to Phoenix at some point, they ended up having to sail under Clauda. They left Fairhaven because there was a soft south wind. And that, of course, coming from the south, it means it would have pushed them north. And from Fairhaven, to make it up to Phoenix would not have been a big deal if the wind had remained consistent. Of course, it wasn't. And then they were caught up in a strong wind called a Euroquilo, or a Euroclydon. It literally means a wind wave. These would have been hurricane-force winds coming down out of the northeast. Again, I don't really want to spend that much time around that much water. I like to swim. I'm good at it, but there's sharks. So there's sharks everywhere if the water is very deep. I don't care. So anyway, that's just my opinion. I'm not going to try to argue that point, but anyway, would have been a cyclone or a hurricane force winds coming down out of the northeast, which of course would have pushed them to the southwest. So at this point, they're basically forced to let the ship be driven by the wind, and they have a short reprieve near the island of Clauda here. Sorry, something got out of order there. One of my stops got deleted. Oh well. Not a big deal. So let's go back over here. Here's that little island of Clauda. Again, not a great place to stop. But they did have a little bit of a reprieve from the wind, a little bit of a reprieve from the storm. And let's go back here to Acts 27, verse 16. 16 and 17, it says, "Running under the shelter of a small island called Clauda, we were scarcely able to get the ship's boat under control. After they hoisted it up, they used supporting cables and undergirding the ship, and fearing that they might run aground on the shallows of Sirtis, they let down the sea anchor, and in this way let themselves be driven along." So a couple of things that occurred here. The small skiff or the boat that would have been on the ship was basically a vessel that they would use to travel back and forth to shore. It was also kind of the only lifeboat, if you will. Would not have been able to hold all of the prisoners, but in general, prisoners weren't exactly valued for they just weren't valued. Let's just put it that way. And so at this point, they stop and they undergird the ship. Now, doesn't give me any confidence in seafaring, but they have to undergird the ship. Basically, what they have to do is run cables underneath the ship, and they probably did it crosswise to keep the ship from literally being torn apart by the waves and the water. The longer the ship had been subjected to those stresses, they would have had breaks in the planks, they would have had separations, they would have had water coming in and constantly needing to pump it out. So, obviously, being a fear that the ship would be broken apart, they limited the ship's flex by running crosswise cables underneath of it to keep it together. And then they struck sail, if we continue on here. Oh, and they weighed the sea anchor too. They basically let the anchor at the end of its line drag out behind them to literally create a break or a drag so that it would keep them from being just blown out to sea uncontrollably. It gives them at least an opportunity to have the ship pointed in a specific direction. Verse 18 and 19, the next day, as we were being violently storm-tossed, they began to jettison the cargo, and on the third day, they threw out the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. Two quick comments on this. They threw out the, the cargo. What would the cargo have been? Food. Except they didn't throw out one thing. The wheat, right? Because it's mentioned later on. So they threw out everything they didn't need. So, you know that your favorite package of Hostess cakes that you... No, it's gone. Anything they didn't need, they pitched over the side. And the fact that Luke mentions that they threw the ship's tackle overboard, this tells you just how desperate it was. The tackle would have included things like spars, extra planks, and not in this case, but often what it would mean is they would throw the yard sail over with the mainsail still attached to it. And often, depending upon their opportunity, they might even tie the tackle together and throw it out the back, tied to the ship, to again act as a brake to provide more drag to keep the ship from just being tossed and turned out in the sea. Okay? So, I think we'll stop there because we're out of time. Any comments or questions before we close up?
I've actually been in 25-foot swells, and I can't even imagine this is even bigger than that. I mean, there was what's called a perfect storm, I think was a movie, mm-hmm. where they show that little bitty boat. What you're describing as a sea anchor is to try to keep the boat in to ride up, but in some ways are just so tall that there's no surviving them.
Yep.
And you can go on YouTube and watch these guys surf. You know, things that are just huge, and it gets going fast. So I can imagine darkness, no power, being tossed around is just catastrophic. I mean, these guys were probably white as ghosts through this whole thing, and there's just no way to explain it unless you've actually been out in the ocean and experienced something like that. I don't know, John's here. He might have seen... There's catabolic, you know, he skis a lot, and I have, but there's what's called catabolic winds that can come down off of the mountain. And that might be something close that you would feel coming, you know, for us here locally. Mm-hmm. But even that's not what they experienced. It was just catastrophic.
Yep. And that's a good point about being in the dark. It's not like there were lighthouses. It's not like you could see the lights of the city on the shore. There wasn't enough of it there to produce. Hey, that's pretty cool. My battery died. So, absolutely, Mark. That's a good point. It is very difficult to describe how scary this would have been and how difficult and challenging it would have been. And then to see what Paul says should remind you of somebody from the Old Testament. But we'll get to that next week. All right. Thanks for your time, guys.